Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are back for a deep dive into a whole bunch of different topics. So we don't have a guest this week. You guys are just with the three of us. So you're welcome. But I heard that glorious noise there, Radha. What are we drinking?
I am drinking a delightful sparkling rosé from a can, which I impulse bought while checking out at Whole Foods yesterday.
Man, I've walked by that display so many times in so many Whole Foods.
It was a tough day yesterday. Our kid was sick. And so I decided this morning that I would have coffee with vanilla ice cream, blueberry muffins from a box, and a can of sparkling rosé. So I feel like I'm set for Sunday.
That's a pretty perfect Sunday.
I mean, I don't even want to think about the hour of the day at which you were drinking sparkling rosé right now, but I admire you greatly for that.
Don't ask follow-up questions.
I'm not going to.
We're drinking LaCroix, grapefruit LaCroix, in case anybody wondered just how basic we were. That's pretty much summing it up, I feel like, right there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I feel good about it.
Okay, we have a lot to talk about this week, which we say every week, I know, but we've got some...
We have greatest hits, and then we have more fun, I think.
Yes.
To add to the discussion.
I think that's right. So if we start off on keeping up foreign relations, let's go back to one of our greatest hits, North Korea. They've been in the news again this week, starting with, turns out our spy agencies decided to tell the Washington Post that the North Koreans were building new missiles, as you do.
You know, I feel like maybe the Post just has like an outlet that they have hooked up to the NSA or CIA or NGA.
Let's not make that suggestion.
It was clearly just marked top secret, well, WAPO.
And there was that. To be fair, our friends in the open source community, Melissa Hannum, Jeff Lewis, and others, have been tracking a similar result.
That's right.
But have not had the intelligence to back it up, or have not had the public intelligence to back it up. So, I mean, yet again, despite the president's declaration via tweet some weeks ago that North Korea would no longer be a threat, a nuclear threat of any kind, they do appear to be continuing to invest in any number of nuclear and missile activities. However, like, they didn't really promise to do anything otherwise, so we shouldn't be surprised by that.
Right. There was also a UN report that was released on Friday that corroborated this, saying that North Korea was continuing its nuclear and missile programs. It's important to remember those are two distinct engineering or scientific activities, and we're still in violation of a number of UN Security Council resolutions, and we're actually doing some additional like ship-to-ship transfers of oil and coal, which kind of suggests that the sanctions regime or the maximum pressure campaign may be thinning out or waning. It's not quite so maximum. It's sort of just, you know, middling pressure, perhaps. But that the broader effort that brought, we think, North Korea to the table, you know, earlier this year, is a little bit thin.
Well, this is partially our own or the United States government's fault. But after the Singapore summit, they did not put as much emphasis as they should have on the we need to continue the maximum pressure campaign. Secretary
exactly.
Pompeo has this week kind of reemphasized this, particularly with regard to Russia and others being possibly in violation of some of those sanctions agreements. But I mean, with us declaring like, all right, guys, everything's good, we're fine now, I can fully understand why other countries would be like, all right, let's start to back off of this, even if technically by the UN agreement, they should not have done so.
Yeah. And I think that's a very good point, and also highlights this sort of broader issue, which is it can be helpful when senior leaders meet and talk and, you know, kind of can move the ball forward a little bit. But there has to be actual work happening around those high level meetings, or you end up in the situation we're in, which is the institutional structures that precipitated senior leaders meeting fail to keep up with what happens afterwards, and we kind of regress instead of making forward progress. And here I feel like the symbolic we won, we got everything done, really kind of took the pedal off the gas. Is that the right analogy? Yeah.
Kind of, for the maximum.
Well, I think that this is where, you know, and Trump didn't do Pompeo any favors. I mean, there's a world in which you could come out of Singapore and say, this was an incredibly important first step. This is what we got out of it. And now that we have the North Koreans in direct talks, this is the way forward, and seeing it as the beginning of the process and not the end. And I think this, you know, gets to sort of, we'll talk about this a little bit in a minute, but sort of Trump's desire for foreign policy by summit, but none of the actual underlying work.
I mean, one of the interesting things to me about the result from North Korea is that the biggest steps that have been taken since then have been on the United States side, in the form of us pulling down some of our major military exercises, which was something that Trump wanted to do anyway. Like, it's effectively saying, like, this was a win coming out of Singapore that was a policy move that Trump has basically wanted to pursue, at least since his campaign, if not before that, was more or less a cover for being able to do so. So we've checked that box, but what else is going to happen next on the North Korean side? Though, to be fair, we did have the transfer of what are purported to be remains of American soldiers who were killed in the Korean War several decades ago, though those still have to be tested to find out if they actually are indeed American remains.
All that said, there was actually an interesting Atlantic article this week that kind of parsed the evidence, primarily the satellite evidence of this missile activity in North Korea from a couple different angles. And, you know, one was basically, you know, friend of the show, Jeff Lewis, saying, you know, this looks like missile activity, and that suggests it's sort of in violation of the spirit. You know, well, he wouldn't have said it's violation of the spirit of the agreement because he was of the opinion that there is no actual agreement. The flip side is that even if you were North Korea and you actually did want to have good faith negotiations going forward, you would actually continue to do these sorts of things because they're your hedge. You don't actually know that the Americans are going to agree to any of your security questions or make any security guarantees in the long term. And so to keep your maximum position, right, for them to continue a campaign of maximum pressure from the North Korean side, you would, of course, continue production of fissile material and missiles because those weren't specifically prohibited in any document that was agreed to or signed. And so, I mean, I tend to be a little bit more skeptical, but the trying to read intent, you know, remotely getting intent from satellites is, in fact, as it turns out, rather difficult. And so we're still trying to play this game of figuring out what exactly they are going to sign up to in the long term. And, you know, the Trump administration and Secretary Pompeo in particular are in the very awkward position of having to be quite credulous to what the North Koreans are willing to commit to. And that's going to be a fraught position for them in the long term.
So in other parts of the world, there was an interesting election. Was it last week?
I believe so.
I guess actually technically has not actually concluded, I don't believe.
Yes, they're waiting for final results.
Right.
In Pakistan.
Yeah. And actually, it's a little bit of a mess. Like many elections in many places, not limited to Pakistan. But I think the big issue, well, the two big issues are, one, the party that won and the leader, Imran Khan, didn't actually have enough votes to be in charge themselves. So even if the election results are certified, there's still going to be some sort of coalition formation. And that's going to be important for understanding what the policies and kind of where that government is going to sit. But kind of more troubling, I think, was the general complaints about this election as being sort of marred by a lot of violence and suppression. So there was, of course, the suicide attack near Quetta, but there was also, you know, a lot of suppression of voters, of rallies, all largely thought to be by the military sort of shaping the environment so that Khan and his party could win. So there have been a lot of complaints and contestations of the election. A couple of people in the region, though, have also called to congratulate Khan on the results. I think the Indian prime minister just called recently. Afghanistan's head has called. So, you know, it's a slightly messy outcome, but I think the outcome is less concerning than the process that led into it, like many things.
So Imran Khan was previously best known as a cricket player.
That is correct. Charismatic cricket player.
Everything I know about Imran Khan is from like Vanity Fair circa about like 10 years ago. and like imagine him wearing like all white linen, mm-hmm. surrounded by very wealthy women.
Very dashing.
That's right.
That's pretty much my image of how he will rule Pakistan, which is probably not in any way accurate.
So he's,
no, that's pretty much what he campaigned on.
Okay, that's great.
Pakistan's got its own celebrity prime minister now, so that's pretty interesting. And as Radha notes, like the role of the military going into this, sort of their tacit or overt support, they're also involved potentially in orchestrating some protests against the previous government, which would have led to this election situation in the first place. Of course, Pakistan is a place where the military has been involved in either direct rule or deposing prime ministers previously. So kind of on the one hand, it's great that Imran Khan gets along so well with the Pakistani army. On the other hand, not great for norms of civilian control or other such things in what's been a relatively fragile democracy in Pakistan.
Now, how long has it been since a Pakistani prime minister has served their full term?
Oh, gosh.
A long time.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm not really sure why you'd want the job, but hey.
So the main reason any of us know anything about Pakistan, I would have to guess, is because it sits next door to Afghanistan, one of our other greatest hits. We haven't talked about Afghanistan in detail in a while. I think the last time we noted that Scotty Miller was heading over there to replace Mick Nicholson as the commander. There was a report out this week that there is a new strategy for Afghanistan. And let's put that in Radha's air quotes, because it's not so new. We have definitely been here before. Radha, what's the deal with the new strategy?
Second verse, same as the first.
Oh my gosh. A little bit louder and definitely a little bit worse. Yes.
So I guess the basic approach is we're going to pursue peace now.
Well, before we get to the pursue peace, we're going to protect the cities.
Right. We're going to pull out of the rural areas and move back both U.S. and primarily Afghanistan forces to protect cities, which has been, as you point out, something that we have done before, and also sort of a tacit recognition that the Taliban right now controls more territory than it did in, for example, 2016, when we were ostensibly drawing down. We have added troops since that point in time and are supposed to be on a more aggressive strategy against the Taliban, as well, more aggressive strategy against terrorists. Whether or not that includes the Taliban, well, right, that's a whole other discussion. But I just find it to be this really sort of sad moment for the Trump administration that was going to go in, at least on the defense side, and turn one more corner in Afghanistan. And yet we are drawing back to a strategy that we have tried before.
Well, in fairness, before we called them like key terrain districts. So now we're calling. So we're changing some names. I think that's important for branding purposes.
Mm-hmm. I was reading this New York Times article that laid out these sort of strategy as they obtained from the Defense Department. Of course, it's not been publicly discussed or publicly released.
And has been, in theory, been being implemented since January, I think.
Sure.
So like this has been going on for a long time and we're just not hearing about it because that's how we do national security under Trump.
And so, you know, we're going to pull back to the cities, which not only have we tried before, but the Soviets before us also had a secure the cities strategy. And so that basically revolves around Kabul, Kandahar, Mazar-i-Sharif, Jalalabad, all places that are familiar for folks who have spent time in Afghanistan, but definitely raises the question of what the hell the Marines are doing in Helmand. Because there are not real population centers there. I guess you could be like super interested in invested in Lashkargah, but we're about to send a whole new task force over there. So anyway,
how many times have we done that before?
All of the times.
Yes.
We have done that all of the times before. And, you know, like there are days where I feel like I could be talked into a sort of long-term counterterrorism presence that had regular rotations and you could man against that. You could do force planning and equipment against that. But we instead sort of just toggle between this, you know, sometimes trying to secure the population, sometimes trying to push out, you know, into more rural areas. And of course, it's definitely a fraught strategy. We won't even go into all of the, you know, just how much do you want to link the population to the civilian government here? You know, usually if you take the counterinsurgency bumper stickers from, you know, the field manual, protect the population, population is the prize. The idea of that is, one, in a rural setting, and two, because they know where the bad guys are and who they are. They aren't the prize in and of themselves. And so sitting on top of the population in cities does very little good in terms of actually expanding government presence and securing the population against terrorist or insurgent infiltration.
On top of which, you both would know better, but if I remember correctly, in Afghanistan, there's a significant portion of the population is actually rural.
Oh, yeah.
Or rural. I had the hardest time with that world. Close to 50%?
I mean, population counts in Afghanistan aren't great, but
right.
Yeah, I think a sizable set of the population is rural. I would also say we have never been great in Afghanistan at defining what like our end game or scope of mission is. And I say that because if what you want is counterterrorism and preventing massive attacks, either against your own forces or sort of attacks that can be exported, you have a really different strategy than if what you're trying to do is sort of establish some kind of legitimate governance presence. And in this case, if we're really worried about Taliban or Al-Qaeda forces or jihadi forces more broadly, depending on who you think is doing what where, being like, we're just going to leave totally uncovered large swaths of this area where you can get together, train, practice, and then attack our troops in known locations or export terrorism to other places is like not the most effective counterterrorism strategy. If what you want to do is sort of protect population centers and we have other strategic objectives for that, that's fine. But, you know, sort of going back to where we started, I think a lot of this is going to hinge on what our objectives are and whether we think sort of a peace treaty or negotiations with the Taliban are really, I don't know, worth it.
So funny you should mention that. it turns out...
Not ha-ha funny.
Not ha-ha funny. But it turns out that we have, for the first time in a very long time, maybe since 2011, are in direct talks with the Taliban. So there was a report from Spencer Ackerman in the Daily Beast that on two fronts. One, that on July 23rd, there was a meeting in Doha between a senior State Department official and representatives of the Taliban, and that that had been preceded by months of sort of shadow diplomacy or informal discussions between Taliban officials and Robin Raphael and Chris Kalenda, two folks that are familiar to people who've worked Afghanistan and Pakistan over the last 10 or more years. That was surprising to me. One, I had heard nothing about the informal talks, and it was interesting that those had progressed as far as they had. And two, it seems that we are potentially willing to have a formal conversation with the Taliban about what they and we would consider in an actual peace deal. And so there's potentially some really interesting developments there, including the Taliban, Radha, to your point, saying that they would be willing to agree. Potentially, this is all kind of, it's a bit more than speculative, but definitely not written down on paper, would be willing to police against future terrorist groups taking, they don't want a repeat of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. So they would, if they were part of the government, they would not be willing to host or play host to foreign terrorist organizations. Now, that's at least as much about ISIS as it is anything else. And it's sort of interesting to think about how the ISIS attacks and ISIS competition has played into the Taliban calculus here. But very much an interesting development on the long-term peace settlement or, you know, negotiations that would, of course, also have to include the Kabul government at some point as well.
Right, which and haven't to date, which is also sort of an interesting and different approach.
Yes.
But it's what's odd to me, and well, this is a good transition to our next discussion we want to have, is that I believe it was last summer President Trump said in public that he did not support negotiating with the Taliban and was very much against it. This was when, in parallel, there may have been some leaks or indicators that we were thinking about it on the U.S. side. So either he doesn't know about it, which seems very plausible, or his mind has been changed, which would actually go along with like how he likes to run foreign policy, doing these big summit negotiations, negotiating with the bad guys.
So let's talk about that for a little bit. I was struck as I was reading this article about the Taliban negotiations, well, of a comment that the president made earlier this week, which was that he'd be happy to talk to the Iranian government with no preconditions, which, of course, sent Twitter into, well, a Twitter and set everybody else kind of into a frenzy, but is sort of a shift in how we've at least publicly discussed diplomatic efforts. You know, if that something like that were to come to pass, you know, you would have direct negotiations with the North Koreans, you know, at the presidential level. You would have ongoing peace talks with the Taliban in a direct manner and potentially direct conversations with the Iranian government. That seems like a big deal and kind of different from how we've done things previously.
So I want to take a second to define a couple of little terms here.
Fine.
But so I think what we are seeing is a willingness at a presidential level to have, exactly as Lauren said, talk, sort of grand gestures and engagements at a very high level. I kind of want to break that apart from negotiations because it's not clear what types of agreements, deliverables, or concrete actions come out of these. And I, as a like sort of model to remember, not saying that there weren't tons of problems and lots of issues with it, but the Iran deal, you know, there was a sort of kickoff in negotiations from a meeting with President Obama and the Iranian government sort of on the front end. And then years of really detailed staff work going up to the Secretary of State, but actually a lot of it at, you know, very specialized staff at both State and Department of Energy. And this sort of back and forth between Kerry and his counterpart Zarif and Secretary Moniz and his counterpart to really define the terms of the agreement and then sort of get leadership of other countries on board. And so what we're not seeing in the Trump administration is the grand gestures as an opening foray to direct concrete work or actions yet, at the very least. So maybe that could come. And so we seem to have a strategy of not exactly negotiating with bad guys, but sort of making grand gestures to sweep a lot of the complexity of the problems under the table. And leadership level meetings can do that. And individual talks can't.
I had a parallel thought, Radha. So that's interesting that one reason Trump likes this style is that the Obama version basically gave him a report card that other people could judge him on and say that, like, you did this well or you did this poorly, and I don't like this, I do like this. The Trump version just has this very, very high level statement that looks good, looks as though, you know, history has been made in some way. Nixon goes to China, but does not have any of the nitty gritty that it is not even really associated with any nitty gritty that's going to follow from that. Like, it's, we'll have kind of a continuing doing business with North Korea in some way, but it's not as linked to a, you know, a timeline or agreed set of deliverables or a, you know, set of parameters that we're negotiating within.
Or verification plans or things right. that could be objective in that regard.
He gets the win without having to do the homework.
I mean, the flip side, of course, is that President Obama, as a candidate, said that he'd be willing to talk to Iran, North Korea, Cuba directly, and was fairly well pilloried for those comments. And I do think it does raise a question. I mean, the Nixon goes to China comment is, you know, there's a lot of history and implied events packed into that. But one of the things about Nixon goes to China is that, you know, they would, it would not have been acceptable or politically acceptable for a Democrat to have done that. And that's always sort of said, well, you need like a hardliner to make peace. And there's sort of parallels in the Israeli peace process, for example, Israeli-Palestinian peace process. But the flip side of that is, like, the reason why that would be the case is that if a Democrat had gone to China, someone, and by someone, I mean exactly Richard Nixon, would have been the one, like, putting the shiv in the process, right? That would have been the one raking them over the coals. And so it's very interesting to me that we have a Republican president, even as controversial a Republican president as Donald Trump, who's pursuing, I almost don't want to say diplomatic initiatives, because I think Radha's right. These are not negotiations. These are just high level summits. They're not engendering any opposition from the Republican side. And in some ways, I think it's good to initiate these talks, but I'm very worried, particularly on North Korea, but certainly Iran could play into this in a similar way, that you then see nothing materialized from them, or we make concessions and get very little in return, and it discredits the whole process over time from both Democrats and Republicans. And so you get this sort of politicized foreign policy moment with not a lot of outcome, and then we're back to square one or even negative square two in the, you know, 5 years from now when we're trying to put the pieces back together.
Yes. That's right. No, I think, and this maybe is a useful, another transition point to, is that there's a real risk from having these super political conversations on topics that we had hoped we'd kind of moved a little bit beyond politics for, and thus have this risk as we move from administration to administration, or are sort of subject to domestic vagaries that we don't actually know what is going to happen, which doesn't lead to good talks, and that is exactly what's happening with our negotiations with Europe.
On trade.
On trade.
On trade.
And we have a new segment.
We have a new segment. And before we like dig into the details, which we're going to have Radha walk us through, because I definitely lost the plot on the EU trade negotiations, for example, we went through a bunch of names, possible names. I really wanted something like Colbert's Revenge or Ricardo Was Right. Was told that those were in fact not funny or entertaining. So,
and also nobody would get them except for like weirdos
like Radha.
Yeah
So instead
we went with, this is such a deep cut here, Money It's Aghast,
which now is a misreading
of a actually we shouldn't even tell Radha. Do you know what that is?
No idea, guys. Okay, I missed it on our internal discussion, and I was like, I don't know what these kids are doing.
There's a song by this band called Pink Floyd.
You may have heard of them, maybe?
I have heard of them.
Okay, good.
And they have a song called Money.
Yeah, okay. The lyric is actually Money, It's a Gas, which I shared with Aaron, to which Aaron responded, what?
That's the line? Because I, of course, know the song because I listen to Pink Floyd fairly often. But, of course, also get the lyrics wrong all of the time. So, Money, It's a Ghast, with a T, is the new name for your segment. And please tell us more about what happened with the EU president when he visited the White House 2 weeks ago.
So just as a reminder for folks, earlier this summer, the U.S. decided to impose some tariffs on the Europeans, including on aluminum and steel. This was in principle to help our auto manufacturers be more competitive. in response, the Europeans taxed all sorts of things, including bourbon and blue jeans. And in my one of my most favorite negotiating lines ever was the quote from Juncker that they could do stupid too. So we're literally making everything stupider by our current trade policies, which is awesome. And then that was followed up with just about 2 weeks ago now, President Trump referring to the European Union as foes, which is a real turnaround from our historic, you know, friendly relationship with Europe as key allies and partners on all of the things. So it was going to be very interesting to come into this meeting. So what happened here was that Trump and Juncker met. Apparently, flashcards were used to explain simple economic terms and processes to the president.
I'm in favor of that. If we wanted to have some of those around here, that would probably go a long way. I'm just saying. But we're not going to rename the segment for you.
Well, I can make flashcards. I'm not sure they're like so effective on the podcast, but maybe some pictures we can include in our show notes. I'll hold like giant cards like they do in Congress with little graphs.
That'd be awesome.
So the key kind of outcome of this was that Donald Trump, you know, claimed a major trade victory and claiming that he had secured a new trade deal with the European Union, in part thanks to our maximum pressure against our European foe strategy of tariffs. Now, the New York Times actually has a pretty good recent piece, and we'll include it in the show notes, kind of laying out the different kinds of costs that are already showing up from the tariffs we've put into place, which are largely direct costs because things are more expensive, like aluminum and steel. Indirect cost increase from the fact that we have sort of global supply chain markets. And then this sort of like more amorphous thing that nobody's really sure what to do with, investor and manufacturer confidence, which is basically when people are making longer term investment decisions, they don't totally know what the prices of things are likely to be because nobody's sure what's happening with tariffs and prices of goods. So they make less of those decisions. And that actually is a sort of drag on growth and investment. All of that is relevant because Trump claimed a victory, but much like our foreign policy negotiations, nobody actually knows what's included in this trade deal. And of particular concern, though President Trump claimed to have opened the market for agriculture, is the fact that agricultural issues are kind of off the table. So maybe the Europeans are going to buy soybeans, but otherwise, meh. And so that's kind of where we are. We have a trade-ish deal.
A trade deal-ish.
Yeah. And the Europeans are going to publish regular numbers on how many soybeans they buy from us.
Super. I mean, the chances that the Europeans can make up for the lack of Chinese buying is going to be, I think, doubtful.
Correct.
You know,
given that is a sort of fundamental part of Chinese cuisine and economy and not so much on the European side, even though I learned this week that soybeans were originally an old world crop.
Oh,
look at
you. That, there you go. And I mean, it's not just that, of course, the tariffs with China are a problem, but also like Mexico and Canada, with whom we trade actually quite a lot.
And on account of them being land neighbors
next to us. Right. And so like agricultural issues have always actually been pretty sensitive between the U.S. and Europe. There's a lot of domestic constituencies here in the U.S. They have a pretty big lobby and frankly are pretty pissed at the tariff regime. So pissed that the Trump administration tried to suggest a like, I think, $10 to $12 billion bailout plan to compensate farmers in the U.S. for the cost from tariffs.
It wasn't a bailout though, Radha, because we're making farming great again.
We are.
Also, I have to say that I'm not willing to take too many lectures from the Europeans on farm subsidies or anti-competitive trade practices with regards to agricultural goods, just in case they were wondering.
And I don't think we should. I think it's just always been a fraught part of the relationship.
For sure.
And basically, in the discussions with the Europeans, they just agreed not to really talk about them, which is nice if you want to have a big moment where you say you solved all the trade problems, but not actually useful for solving any trade problem.
And so we're basically just moving into like full mercantilism, right? Where we're putting tariffs on things for strategic or alleged security purposes, but really to like score points or do battle internationally, and then doling out subsidies or other rewards to domestic constituents that we care about if they are disproportionately suffered, but not taking efficient economic model of freer trade and more diffuse benefits domestically. It's all winners and losers, and the only person who can pick winners is the president.
That's right. And actually, even worse than that is we're sort of like breaking the whole system. So folks may remember that the way we're imposing these tariffs while not breaking the law is by claiming this national security exemption to the free trade agreements we have.
Under the World Trade Organization rules, right?
Correct. And Russia has also been doing this and had a case in front of the WTO related to them essentially making it impossible for Ukraine to transport stuff on Russian roads, which they need to do, ostensibly for national security reasons, but essentially causing huge economic costs to Ukraine because they need these roads for land travel.
Whose side did we take on this dispute?
I know, and it's like the tension is really mounting as the dramatic announcement is that we took Russia's side.
Ooh.
I mean, who could have guessed? And the important thing is that Russia's using that same national security exemption we do. So it's a really different sort of case and substance of the like facts of the case are very different than the ones we would have. But the U.S. has cases coming up later this summer under this same rule. And this same decision, this idea that if you claim the national security exemption, it can't even go to the WTO to be reviewed. Like, you get an automatic pass on anything you do as soon as you say the words national security. And so, you know, that's the kind of way the Trump administration wants national security exemptions to be reviewed. A lot of other parties to the agreement think that you should have to justify why it's a legitimate national security exemption. So we're, you know, clearly in this case, taking this side for our own self-interested reasons, but also kind of realize we're now going to start seeing this national security exemption right. as a way to be used without really any international order or oversight.
Okay. Well,
okay. So fun.
Thanks.
But next time, let's talk about NAFTA.
It's a gassed.
It's a gassed. Okay. So I think with that, we are switching to White House mayhem. And it's really, it's an omnibus White House mayhem.
It is.
We're going to talk about the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. And I should say that this is the Authorization Act for the Defense Department, not the budget. There are authorizers and appropriators on Capitol Hill. And with that, we have exhausted my knowledge of the legislative branch.
OMG, I love this so much. Okay. All right. All right.
But this is the authorization, which means that there's lots more than just budget numbers.
It is a 2,500 page piece of legislation plus reports. And we should be clear, we're recording on Sunday. Right now, it is not yet law. So I guess technically, if the president wanted to, he could veto it, but seems highly unlikely that he will do so. And we've talked about the NDAA a lot before. I think it's important to know a couple of things broadly about the NDAA. One, it is one of the most detailed policy documents that comes out of the Hill every year. This is the SASC and the HASC staff are highly professionalized. They put a ton of work into these documents that actually, fascinatingly to me, are rarely talked about in public hearings. The HASC does their markup of the legislation publicly, but even then, it's this rush overnight in order to get all of this done with very few hearings leading up to it. The SASC does theirs privately. They do have hearings leading up to it, but they are not talking about every single tiny piece of legislation that is within the context of that. And it goes over to the Pentagon, and they usually bitch and moan about it in some way. Earlier this year, if you are super nerdy, you should read the Statement of Administration Policy, the SAP, that was done both to the Senate and House versions, which is basically the DOD litany of complaints about the first drafts of this bill.
The airing of grievances.
The airing of grievances, because this airing of grievances was quite grievancy. it was quite grievancy, particularly for CivMil nerds, in terms of taking away what they said were taking away authorities from the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and handing them over to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. But I'll pause there to ask both of you, what were your favorite pieces of the NDAA?
So I'll go first with two sort of widely disparate ones. One was this inclusion. I think Jackie Speier was, who's on the House, was the person who initiated it. But this idea that if you're convicted of a sexual assault and you're a senior military official, we should review whether you should get to keep your security clearance, which just adds to this general confusion as to what a set of criteria should matter when you have a clearance or not, and B, what exactly our policy on what happens when you're a senior official and you commit a sexual assault or sexual harassment in the military. And I myself follow this pretty closely and still am not totally sure. But the other one, and really a big favorite of mine, is that the Office of the Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict, which is the civilian office that in principle oversees the Special Operations Forces, so that has a service secretary-like function, got a bunch of civilians and a couple more authorities and is really trying to consolidate into being a super awesome service secretary. So I would say watch for that as there are studies coming out to look at how Weathersoft should be, in fact, its own service. And that's included in this NDA, as well as some additional small authorities, additional authorities to the commander of SOCOM, and additional oversight and staffing for the civilian branch.
Would that, if that were to happen, so right now Solix sits within the Office of the Secretary of Defense. If they became a service secretary, and let's just point out that it's ridiculous that an Assistant Secretary of Defense is supposed to oversee a four-star command in Tampa. Like, that's
right.
Ridiculous on its face. That's
and oversight reflects that.
Yeah. Okay. So, but if they became a service secretary, they would move outside of the secretary, Office of the Secretary of Defense. They moved outside OSD and they'd be on the service secretary side, like all the other branches. Would we still have Solic, or would it be, or who knows?
It would be Super Solic.
Super Solic. Okay. That's extra super.
We've Super Solic'd Solic before, but we kept it within OSD. It was a special operations, low intensity conflict, and force transformation.
Yikes. Okay, yeah. Lauren, what was your favorite part?
Okay, I had two, kind of related to my earlier comments. One, there is a fairly benign looking component of it that basically just like lays out, here are the responsibilities of the Undersecretary of Defense for policy. And it has things like there about, like, you know, oversee plans and develop the planning guidance for the budget and various other things that if you read it, you're like, well, duh, of course they do that. So the background of that, if you go back and look at the Senate version, was initially significantly more aggressive, basically asserting that policy had been weakened in some way over the last decade and needed to be strengthened and reassert its civilian oversight role. This is where the chairman side came back in the SAP and said, like, no, you're stealing away from our authorities. This is very bad in some way. So the fact of its weakening is interesting to me, as well as to see how Mattis or anyone takes that legislation, because they could totally ignore it because it's literally just like copying and pasting into a directive. Or they could say, oh, wow, I have an entire office that gives me power. Amazing. I should totally use that in some form instead of only listening to the joint staff. The second piece that was interesting to me is a report that I assume OSD, but someone is required to do examining train, advise and accompany missions, which we talked a bit about before, mm-hmm. looking at the legal and policy authorities that support those and go back to the Hill, providing more information on that. Again, it's only a report. It's just a first step, and it's kind of up to DOD and Congress to see what the next step is. But to me, that's a good sign to realize that maybe we have not provided as much useful oversight and rationality to these sorts of missions as we should have in the past.
Interesting. Okay, so my favorite part, and it's probably the part that got the most discussion, at least online this week, it relates to military promotions and sort of manpower and recruiting retention more generally. And I think that these were some, or at least they're akin to some of the Force of the Future recommendations that had been under discussion in the Obama administration. But there's several different prongs to it, but among them are sort of moving away from a pure up or out system for promotion for all specialties, which is to say that some folks could remain at a certain rank longer than they otherwise would for certain specialties such as cyber or even logistics. So that's interesting. Conversely, faster promotions for some folks as they rocket through the ranks. And third, and perhaps most interestingly, although I'm fascinated to see how this is actually going to be used, direct commissions for officers up to the rank of colonel for certain, again, sort of exquisite skills or specialties. So the math on this is going to be tricky, and these are things that they're authorized to do. They are not required to do any of these, and I think implementation will vary by service, and that will be kind of interesting to watch for bureaucratic politics reasons. But if you have some folks staying longer in grade and others rocketing through, you're going to have some very uneven packets when you come up for board review at some future point, but could be something that actually lets people, you know, stay at an appropriate rank and keep key skills. I think it should be extended well beyond cyber. I also think that, like, cyber command should be a civilian command, so I'm probably not the person to talk to. Not in the NDAA, but also happening this week was Space Force.
Dun, 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 dun.
So there was supposed to be a report delivered this week. It was in fact not delivered, but it still got leaked to Defense One. And so we can still sort of talk about it. And it has a number of things that we've talked about previously about what Space Force might look like. And interestingly, it seems like the department is actually out ahead of Congress, because only Congress can create a new uniformed service. But the Department of Defense is doing a number of things to get out ahead of Space Force, which is interesting because they super don't want one. And so I'm kind of intrigued by the things that are in the report, which the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Pat Shanahan, put together. They include a new 4-star combatant command, which would be kind of like SOCOM, I think.
I know.
A new procurement element.
I'm just so excited.
Which would basically buy satellites better than we currently do, is the argument. And a new space operations force, which would sort of, much like SOCOM does, manage all of the space specialists as one community, which means we aren't getting new uniforms yet, which means...
What's the point?
I've totally lost interest, but these are all of
but
the things
that... But they could get
that...
special hats, guys.
Okay, that's totally true. They special could have special hats. Because the soft guys get special hats.
That's so true.
That's right.
To think about
I'm
what
just
their
saying,
special hats could be.
Hats are on the table, folks.
It would be very
what about capes? I think capes are relevant as well.
No capes.
Okay.
Edna Mode. Very correct.
All right.
As much as I like Keurig's cape in Rogue One,
it's
I think...
a great cape.
I think no capes is probably going to stay. Lauren, your colleague Paul Shari had a really good article about... well, and by article, I mean some tweets that they stitched together into an article, but about why this is actually a really bad idea. And he makes this, I thought, a very compelling point, but one that I want to be interesting to hear kind of how it's tested over the next few months, which is that, you know, the reason people want a space force is that space is, as they say, congested, contested, and competitive. And things are really vulnerable in space. It's hard to do defense in space. It's very easy to do offense in space. So if you wanted to take out a satellite, you could fairly straightforwardly. We have a lot of capabilities in space. All of our what's called C4ISR, command, control, communications, computers.
Something else?
And then intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets. A lot of those are in space. We also do precision navigation and timing through a lot of space-based assets. And so Paul's argument is twofold. One, that if you create a space force, they're going to continue to be committed to putting A, things in space, hence the name, and two, probably putting big things in space, which is basically how we do these capabilities right now. That's bad, because what they should be committed to is the mission, the C4ISR mission, the precision navigation and timing capabilities, and that we should find any and all ways of doing that, not just through space-based assets. And I have to say, I found that kind of compelling, and his arguments about bureaucratic politics are reasonable.
Yeah. So just like one quick point on that, which I myself am very interested to see, is I think the bureaucratic politics bit, I mean, this the composition of the Space Force Command looks a lot like the Special Operations Command. And so it will be interesting to see, A, how much they can port some of the useful like procurement tools and,
yeah, exactly.
and sort of abilities from that without a lot of the complications and frankly crappiness in terms of how SOCOM navigates sort of force requirements and training requirements across services, part A. But part B, whether they can actually use this to deal with some of the concerns that Paul rightly raises, namely, do we need to be sending big things into space, or is like having a special force that can actually think about smaller scale procurements and smaller scale options in space a mechanism to get us away from that direction that we're going? And I don't know that it will, but it certainly could. And so it will be interesting, Aaron, as you say, to kind of see this play out over the next few months on how the conversations and actual actions look.
And it'll be interesting to see how Congress comes back around on this, because these are all things that the department has basically told Congress that it's going to do. And they could be like, that's cute, but let me tell you how you're actually going to do this. So
I mean, this could be a play from DOD to just to tie this issue up for the next 5 years.
Oh, look at you, devious.
Yeah.
Love it. Okay. Pop culture. I believe we've all have some.
Yeah.
Rada, what did you see? You saw a movie?
I saw Ready Player One, guys.
Oh, yeah. I've actually never seen it yet.
It's good. I mean, a couple of caveats here. One, I don't know anything about the book. Two, I don't know anything about video games. But that having been said, it's a delightful romp through a future dystopian world with video games at the center of it. So, you know, if you're looking for a Saturday afternoon movie to watch, I recommend it-ish. If you can't watch Mamma Mia 2, that is.
I was going to say, on the opposite side of the spectrum, I went to see Mamma Mia 2 by myself, and it was wonderful. Everyone should go see it at least like 7 times. I think the best parts of it were clearly Colin Firth, Pierce Brosnan, and Stellan Skarsgård, as well as Andy Garcia. He was basically the hottest man on the face of the earth. And then suddenly Cher shows up at the end, and it was great.
Of course she was.
I'm not wearing palazzo pants though. I'm
okay,
just saying.
And I want to disclose in the middle of this, I proposed to Rada and Aaron that we start our own girl band and sing together ABBA covers. And I was, Aaron just shut me down immediately. There's no hope. I'm I'm sorry, everybody.
I mean, they can have a girl band. I'm just not going to be in it.
All right.
It's just pretty much
would
how
that
happens.
Would you be in it if you didn't have to wear palazzo pants?
Or sing ABBA covers.
Oh,
well. So, right.
What if we sometimes sing
so
Pink
let's have
Floyd.
A summit and we can just not talk about any of those details. But
great.
I saw The Spy Who Dumped Me. Which it turns out is extremely my shit. It's a kind of girl power spoof of a spy movie while actually being a quite good action flick. So if you have a self-imposed Tom Cruise ban like I do, but still would like to see a kind of espionage-driven action story, I highly recommend this one. I thought it was a hoot.
And on that note, oh, we should remind everybody, none of us are interested, but apparently some of you might be, that there's going to be a new Star Trek following the career of Jean-Luc Picard.
I mean, the only part of Star Trek that I care about at all is Jean-Luc Picard,
that's
I have
true.
To say. So maybe
capes?
I'll be
there could be
that.
Cape inspiration, maybe? Will there
could
be
capes?
No capes.
There's going to be uniforms, I assume. Either that or he's going to be like a retirement home and just like grouching at everybody. Hard to say.
All right, ladies. Thank you. See everybody in a couple weeks.